Good evening and you're very welcome to the Sports Show on 101.4 on FM. Now, coming up on the show tonight, we're going to be talking to pro boxer George Groves, local boy, going to be the next big thing in British boxing. We're also going to be hearing from Scott Minto. He's going to be looking at his old club Chelsea and their great start to the season. Brendan Horgan and Rob Brennan are here as ever. They'll be giving a roundup of the week's sport. It's going to be Floyd Mayweather, Gaelic games, and a whole lot of other stuff. But Rob, very welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Mr. Mulhern. Yeah, start top of the show. We've got the Football Association being criticised on the back of all the papers this morning. They've basically been criticised by the government for failing to implement promised reforms. Sports Minister Jerry Sutcliffe has written to the heads of the FA, the Premier League and the Football League questioning their ability to work together. Sutcliffe expresses disappointment at the FA's apparent lack of development in crucial areas of the national game. The FA has said in response to this that important challenges to the game.
Is this surprising, Rob? This report, were you surprised now as a big football man yourself?
Personally, no. I mean, I think what the people in the FA are living off is the fact that England qualified so well for the World Cup. But what Mr. Sutcliffe basically pointed out is that, you know, the FA must introduce two important independent directors to their main board. And it also highlights the shortcomings in advancing the women's game and planning for youth development, coaching standards and leadership. So while things look good at the top of the game, I think he's spot on about why aren't they developing the game.
Okay, so definitely it sounds like a controversial one there, Rob. Maybe not so controversial, Brendan, but Schumacher is tipping Button for world title chances, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Seven-time Formula One world champion Michael Schumacher says that the title is Button's to lose. He said to a BBC journalist, looking at the situation, I pretty much expect Jensen to fix the title. It's very hard to take it away. But Button isn't being cautious. The world championship leader says that he will go all out for a win at Sunday's Singapore Grand Prix rather than opting for a cautious approach. There's only four races to go and 40 points up for grabs, and Button is 14 points ahead of Rubens Barrichello, with Sebastian Vettel 26 points adrift in third place.
So is Schumacher just saying what everyone's thinking, Brendan?
I think he is, yeah.
Okay, no panic. Brendan, massive comeback at the weekend. I'm just going to ask Rob his opinion on Floyd Money Mayweather, outstanding comeback, one of the great comebacks probably in boxing.
Absolutely. I mean, I questioned it last week, the fact that he'd been out of the ring since 2007 when he beat Ricky Hatton. But, I mean, he returns to beat Juan Manuel Marquez in Las Vegas. It's the first time he's been in the ring in 21 months. But, I mean, he knocks down Marquez in the second round and then peppered him with damaging shots to remain unbeaten. Marquez had actually stepped up two weight classes for the non-title welterweight fight. But basically, this is 32-year-old Mayweather. He dominated all 12 rounds. His left jab is unbelievable. And now his career record is 40-0 with 25 knockouts.
Now the big news after this, Rob, of course, is everyone saying the fight everyone wants is Floyd Mayweather against Manny Pacquiao.
It's got to happen. I think it will possibly be the biggest payday in boxing history. I'm sure it will be. I'd love to see it. I really would. I think the build-up would be very interesting because Pacquiao's not the type to get into slanging matches, and I'd say Mayweather would do everything to get under his skin. So I'd look forward with that.
Very much a foil to each other anyway, Brendan, aren't they, character-wise?
Oh, definitely. The complete opposites of each other. But I've got a funny feeling we may have to wait a little bit longer than we expect for that. Shane Mosley was in the ring after Floyd Mayweather's win. And there's a history also between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao's promoter, Bob Arum. Mayweather doesn't necessarily want to work with Bob Arum. But so rumours have it that it will be Mayweather fighting Shane Mosley and then a Pacquiao fight.
Who would your money be on, Brendan, just quickly?
Money Mayweather all the way. That comeback, we were saying before we went on air, Mayweather must have got hit only 10 times in the whole fight. It's impossible to punch the guy, so if you can't hit him, you're not going to beat him. Mayweather all the way.
Great fight and prospect. Now, that's all the main news of the week. We're going to take a quick music break. When we come back, we'll be talking to local boy George Groves about the pro boxing scene, so join us after this. Hello and welcome back to the Sports Show 101.4 on FM. Now we're joined in the studio by a local boy, pro boxer, and hopefully he's going to be the next big thing in British boxing. George Groves, you're very welcome to the show.
How you doing, guys? Thanks for having me on.
Joe or George, just for our listeners, can you just give us a very quick bit of background on yourself, just local boy and bit about the boxing?
I'm a local boy, and you know, I grew up in Hammersmith and Fulham. I'm just trying to make it in the pro world at the moment, in the pro boxing world. I've been professional for a year now. As an amateur, I won 2 ABA titles. That was my sort of claim to fame as well. And decided, you know, I wanted to have a crack at this professional boxing lark.
Was it always in your mind, George, that you wanted to turn pro when you were an amateur?
Yeah, it's always been a dream of mine, you know. It was my main focus, you know, since I ever started when I was, you know, 7 and 8 years old. I always wanted to be a professional world champion boxer, and, you know, feel like I'm living the dream at the moment. You know, I'm trying to get there, and it's going well at the moment, so I'm happy.
Your first pro win, George, you've had 4 pro wins so far, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. I've got my 5th fight coming up next week. It's gone well so far, you know, 4 out of 4. I've had 3 knockout wins as well, so I think I'm starting to turn heads, you know, with the performances. So if it keeps going, then I'm on track.
How did that first pro win feel, George? Was it your biggest buzz in your whole career of boxing?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some big buzzes, you know, but that was something new and exciting, you know. It was different in that I'd never stepped into a professional ring, so I didn't know what to expect. But, you know, I'd had so many fights in my boxing and kickboxing background, I didn't have any nerves or anything like that. I boxed on David A's undercard, you know, at the O2 Arena, so it was a massive fight for me. I was buzzing about boxing in that huge arena, you know. It was fantastic. So
it sounds like it was everything you expected the pro game to be: big arena, lots of people, you know, big crowds, a bit of like showbiz to it and all that.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I think pro boxing's about. You know, that's what you need to do. You need to entertain people. You know, it's a show business. It's as much as it is a sport. So if you're gonna do well, you need to entertain. You need to put on a show.
What was the biggest difference from amateur boxing, going from amateur going into pro?
Well, last few years, amateur boxing has been about point scoring, you know, especially on international duty. You know, when you're away boxing in foreign countries, it's about picking up points and then, you know, getting on your toes and just claiming that win. So it wasn't always the prettiest, you know. But now, pro boxing, you've got to look good, you've got to train hard, you know, and when you get in the ring, you've got to hit people and make it count, you know. So maybe punching with power and trying to knock people out is the main difference, I think, as being a professional.
Was it a very big decision for you at the time? You know, as you say, you had 2 ABA titles, you were a decorated amateur, lots of international medals abroad. We could kind of look at James DeGale and say, these guys were, you know, they didn't know whether they should stick around for the next Olympics or not. Did you look at some of those boxers and say, well, maybe I would have liked a crack at the Olympics?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was at the time, you know, what I was, my main focus, you know, short term, was to try and get to the Olympic Games, you know. James DeGale got the nod ahead of me, and, you know, I held my hands up, you know, fair play, they made the right decision. The man came back with a gold medal, and I was happy and, you know, pleased that a Londoner achieved something that's really quite phenomenal. But, you know, the next Olympics was 4 years away. You know, anything can happen in 4 years, and I truly believe in 4 years' time I'll be knocking on the door for professional world titles. So it was like a no-brainer for me to turn professional.
George, I was looking at your website, and you had your kind of position up of, you know, where you're in the world, is that right, or where you are in Britain, a kind of ranking?
Yeah, rankings. That? Yeah.
So who would you see ahead of you now at the moment? Who are the guys you have to beat to get to where you want to go?
Well, I mean, looking at the rankings, I'm on course for the goals I've set. You know, the guys behind me are either well behind me, who are supposed to be on the same level as me, you know, have the same amount of contests as me, you know, the same wins and losses, but they're not. You know, I'm ahead of them because I've took difficult fights and, you know, competitive fights. So they're only really, the guys above me are at championship level, so I've got to make that next step up into championship level, you know. I've got a couple of fights, and then at the beginning of next year I want to start fighting for titles, you know. I want to fight, I'm happy to start right at the beginning, you know, southern area and English titles, and then, you know, hopefully move on to, you know, bigger things.
George, did someone come knocking on your door to turn pro, or did you actively seek out a promoter when you decided that the time was right for you?
Yeah, I mean, professional promoters and that have been knocking on the door since I was like 17, you know, and if they didn't, then I didn't do my job correctly, you know. So it was always going to be there when I decided the time was right. And I decided before my last ABAs that, you know, I sat down with my amateur coach. I said, I want to win the ABAs for my club, you know. I want to do something to be remembered, you know, and then I want to go pro, you know. I've made that decision. I wanted to go pro before the Olympics, no matter who did what there, you know. I've made that decision. And then, you know, rumours slip out pretty quick, and then all of a sudden everyone was, you know, wanting to meet up and have chats and see what's best for me, you know. And I sat down and I had a long think, you know, with my family and my girlfriend. She helped me out a lot, and we come to the decision that, you know, Haymaker was the best thing for me, signing with Haymaker Boxing.
And you're delighted with that decision so far?
Yeah, I mean, Haymaker Boxing struggled as late because of the demise of Satanta Boxing, so they don't have any TV, you know, so you don't get the exposure. But I mean, the way I've been performing, it's quite easy for me to just link up with other promoters as such, you know. But I'm still going to have the same team behind me, because the main thing is, you know, in the gym, you know, who you're training with, what you're doing in the gym, you know. But they've got me the best sparring in the world. They've got me, you know, the best facilities in the world. So I can't complain at the job they've done, you know. It wasn't their fault that Satanta went bust, so I'm not quickly to, you know, sack them and on my way, you know. These guys are all right. I want to stay with them, you know. Training alongside, you know, David Hay is fantastic. You know, there ain't many world champions in Britain that you can pick things up off, and he's one of them. So, you know, I just seen that as a blessing.
Is that support important for a pro boxer, George, to have people like that around you in the gym, more experienced boxers, people who have been there before?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my last few amateur bouts, I was sort of top of the tree at my amateur gym, you know, and it's obviously not being big-headed. I was boxing for England, I was winning ABA titles, and everyone was sort of looking up at me, and I was, you know, where the next level, whereas I had no one. Whereas now, I'm in a professional gym, like, across the ring from a world champion, you know, and he's fighting for a heavyweight world title fight. It doesn't get any bigger. So all of a sudden, I've got someone to look up to, and it's really nice, you know. If I've got a problem, I can go to him and say, David, like, what do you think of this? And he can give me his opinion. Whereas, you know, I was missing that before. But now I've got it, and I love it.
George, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be looking at the future for George Groves, and also the training that's involved in getting to where you want to go. So join us after this, folks.
We come on this loop, John B. My grandfather and me. Oh, let me go. Let me go.
Hello and welcome back to the Sports Show 101.4 on FM. We're joined in the studio by pro boxer and local boy George Groves. George, just quickly there before I get back into the second part of the interview, you're nicknamed the Saint. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Where does that come from exactly?
It was David A himself actually came up with that. You know, they came up with a whole heap of names and you know, boxing names that some were awful, really bad, but some of them weren't so bad. And I think Saint was what we came to agree on, and I think it works, you know. It represents me just a little bit, and if I carry on winning, then the more you win, the more you sort of represent your boxing name. That's how it seems to work.
So and as I say, now your next big fight is coming up now in 10 days, is that right?
Yeah, 10 days. Yeah, I'm boxing on October 4th. You know, that's next Sunday, so a week on Sunday. That's at Your Call in Bethnal Green. It comes around so quick, you know. It's been a long time since I've been in the ring, but I've been putting a lot of work on in the gym, and it does come around quick. So as you say, 10 days to go.
Is that very frustrating, George? Because I know as an amateur, you get regular bouts all the time, and
yeah,
then you go from that to the pro game where, you know, you can be doing 2-3 big bouts a year.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, as an amateur, you could box in 5 times in a week. I've done that before. Whereas, you know, as you say, pro boxing is totally different. I've found it fine, you know, it hasn't bothered me at all. I missed out boxing in July, you know, I was supposed to be boxing up in Liverpool in July. So it's been a long time since I've boxed, you know, since April. But because, like, there's no boxing in summertime, you know, it's not as bad as what it really seems, you know. The season started and I'm straight back into it.
Does that mean you can relax now, George, during the summer? Can you, you know, can you have a pint here or there?
You
kind of watch, you know, have that McDonald's now and again?
Yeah, I managed to have 2 weeks out, you know, I meant to get away with my girlfriend for a little short-term holiday. You still got to do a bit of training here and there while you're away, running along the beach or whatever you can find. But since I got back, you know, it's been full training. I've been training for like 10 weeks for this fight.
So you're talking, like, we're talking complete vocation here. It's lifestyle, everything is like gearing up to your next pro fight.
Yeah, I mean, the time you learn your trade is in the gym. It's not actually in the ring. So, you know, when you've got a big gap between bouts, that's fantastic because that gives you time to get in the gym and learn some new stuff. You know, that's what I've been doing. So, I've made sure I didn't go stale by being in the gym too much. But I've been in the gym learning new techniques, some secret weapons, and you know.
And the funny thing now, just from covering amateur, I covered a lot of amateur boxing at home, but you think a lot of the amateurs would know pretty much everything by the time that they get to 23, 24, having grown up all the way through the boxing ranks.
Yeah.
But that obviously isn't the case, right?
No, definitely. Pro boxing is totally different to amateur boxing. And when you're an amateur, you think you're just going to be able to walk in and do what you want to do, but you can't. You know, people like me were told you've got a pro style, you'll be just fine. But, you know, just because you're an aggressive fighter or a come forward fighter, don't mean you've got pro style and you're going to be a good professional fighter. And the way amateurs, you know, is changing, you know, with the point scoring and stuff like that, it's becoming almost like a different sport. So if you want to be a successful professional, you need to give yourself time to do so. You know, you need to be in the pro gym and you need to be working hard in the pro gym for, you know, years if need be. You can't just like slip in after an Olympic medal and expect to take on the world.
Is it a higher fitness?
No, not really. I mean, to be honest, it seems like I train, you know, the intensity is a bit lower now, you know, because you can't batter your body, you know, if you're a professional training every day. You can't have a full-on workout where you're absolutely knackered at the end of it 2-3 times a day, because you've got to give your body time to rest as well. That's where, you know, it's just as important. You know, if you have a hard session, you need to have a hard rest session, and that's where your body's going to heal, repair and become better.
Now, everybody talks about boxers having to make weight and the dreaded scales. You're boxing at super middleweight, George, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Are you
comfortable at that weight?
Yeah, I've actually put on weight, you know, since I was professional. I think it's only 2 pounds, but it's nice. All boxers walk around a little bit heavier than what they actually fight at, you know, and although I walk around heavier than what I am, I'm still growing into that super middleweight frame, you know. Sure. I plan to stay at this weight for a long time. When I went pro, I thought I could do middleweight, but, you know, after I was in the gym a little bit, doing different stuff, you know, my body was getting bigger, I was getting stronger, and all of a sudden, you know, that was an unrealistic target.
Now, just earlier in the first half of the interview, George, you were saying your first fight in the O2, you weren't particularly nervous, but how mentally prepared do you need to be for these pro fights that you're going into?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's immense pressure that you know, that's one slip up, you know, and it could set you back years, you know. So if you go out there and you switch off for a split second, you can get punished. And if you do suffer a defeat or something that's unexpected, then it, as you say, it can set you back. Even a poor performance can be sort of career threatening sometimes.
Sure. And people talk about it, boxing as well, being a very isolated sport and very individual sport. Your support network, how important is that to you? And what is your support network outside of the gym like?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, when you're an amateur, you know, you come from a club, you know, you seem to have loads of friends. And then when you turn professional, it's a job. So you're in the gym. Obviously, you make new friends and stuff like that. But it's a tough place to be, you know. And when things ain't always going your way, you do need someone who you can sort of lean on. Like, I've got a great family who are 100% behind me. You know, I've got good friends. And they appreciate that I can't always go out drinking with them, or I might have to miss someone's birthday. I have to tell my girlfriend, I'm sorry, I can't see you tonight. You know, I'm down the gym. So when people understand, that makes it a lot easier.
So it sounds a lot easier, but obviously it's, you know, very tough. And are you giving yourself a time target of when you want to achieve what you want to achieve in pro boxing?
Yeah, it's hard because you don't want to look too far ahead, you know, and you know, as I say, if you look too far ahead, you're not concentrating on what's exactly in front of you, you can slip up. But as I say, domestic titles is a very realistic goal in the beginning of next year. I plan to have two fights minimum, maybe three, possibly four fights, you know, before Christmas. So that's like four fights in 10 weeks or something. So if I can keep that busy, then I'm going to be more than ready come the beginning of 2010.
George, just a little bit about the opponent now that you're coming up. You were saying there's a bit of an overlap between people you know and your opponent knows.
Yeah, when I announced that I was boxing Matthew Barr, like he's not all that far from me. I think he lives in Surrey or something like that. He's based over that way. A few of my friends have sparred him, you know, and so I'm pretty sure I've boxed a few of his friends over the years or sparred him. So he's going to know a bit about me. I'm going to know probably a little bit about him. But at the same time, you can't take nothing for granted. So I'm just going to be strictly business and
Is he in the game a bit longer than you?
Yeah, everyone I seem to box has been in the game longer than me. He's he's probably got 10 years on me and God knows how many years as a pro on me. I think he's had 14 wins now and he's only lost 3 or 4. So he's experienced, you know, he's been in with some tough guys. I think he's just come off the back of a stoppage win or something. So he's going to be in good form. He's going to be up for the fight.
You'd be bringing a big crowd down to York Hall now Sunday week?
Yeah. It's up to me to bring down the big crowd, I think. I've sold maybe 500 tickets or something, so it's gonna be a nice little mob down there cheering us on.
Does that help, George?
Yeah, it always helps, you know. It's what sometimes it's what you live for, you know. That it's you get that adrenaline. You hear about footballers and other sportsmen now, they can't give up the game because that buzz that they get, and I understand totally what they're talking about, you know. As you're walking into the ring and you know you got loads of people behind you supporting you, and you got music playing and fireworks or whatever's going off, that you just feel on top of the world.
So do you have a strategy now to face Matthew, or are you just going to it as it comes on the night?
Yeah, I'm just going to take it as it comes, you know. I never have a game plan for a particular fighter, because I was thinking, well, if they've got a game plan for me, they're going to change their style, so why should I? You know, I'm going to get in there and adapt to whatever comes at me. The important thing is not to rush, you know, not to look for the knockout. Him being a southpaw as well is going to be interesting, so I don't want to walk onto any silly shots. So,
how many rounds are we looking at, George?
This is going to be an 8-rounder, and I'm not going to give a prediction quite yet.
George, I just want to wish you the best of luck anyway down the York Hall on Sunday the 2nd, and hopefully we'll have you back in the show later in the year and everything will be going well for you.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having us on, guys.
Thanks a million, George. Welcome back to the Sports Show 101.4 on FM. That was local boxer George Groves. One to watch, Rob, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds very impressive. I think we'll be getting down the York Hall on the 2nd to see him in action.
And a nice guy as well. But, Rob, footy. Outside of boxing, footy.
Bit of results.
Yeah, last weekend. Well, I'm not going to get to it yet. We all know what I'm going to get to. But Liverpool, absolutely fantastic result at West Ham United. Fernando Torres showed his class with a 3-2 victory for the Merseysiders there. Arsenal, very convincing, a 4-0 thumping of Wigan Athletic. And then, of course, we got to Sunday and we got to Manchester United and we got a late winner from Michael Owen, which has been clouded in controversy because some are saying it came too late in the game, others are saying you played to the final whistle. So, I don't know where you land. Stay on that one, Rob. What do you think?
What's the on-FM line, Rob? That's what I was just going to ask you.
I think they should have defended better, quite frankly. I know we have late goals. It wasn't that bad. The BBC match today did a whole thing about, it was like 1 second before the ref should have blown the whistle. And at the end of the day, I looked at it and I went, what were you doing, Man City? He was standing there free, so you can only blame yourselves there. But this weekend, we've got United going to Stoke, which is not an easy place to go because they hurled that ball in from Rory Delap. And if you're not up for it, they'll beat you. Fulham against Arsenal at Craven Cottage. That's the late kickoff on Saturday. And we've also got Tottenham Hotspur, who've made a pretty decent start to the season. They're taking on Burnley at White Hart Lane. Queen's Park Rangers, my boys.
Your club.
We actually won. We beat Cardiff last weekend 2-0, convincing goals from Jay Simpson. We got Barnsley on Saturday. Fortunately, we were knocked out of the League Cup last night by Chelsea 1-0. And just a little bit there on Brentford. They've had a decent start to the season, but the defeat last week to Bristol Rovers 3-1. They got Yeovil on Saturday, and then on Tuesday night, get down to Griffin Park because they're taking on Southend United.
So that's the club roundup, Rob. But internationally?
Internationally, well, when Fabio's not putting mud on his wife, which I notice a few papers have been retracting why they put it in the paper at the weekend, but basically the FA have confirmed that the Three Lions will take on Brazil in a friendly match in Qatar in November on the 14th of the month. So this match has been long rumoured because basically there was an agreement with Brazil that they opened the Wembley Stadium and they had to play it at some stage. So I think part of the reason they're going to Doha in Qatar to play it is acclimatisation for playing in South Africa. So 14th of November, England against Brazil.
Will that one be welcomed by the players?
I very much doubt, and I'd say the clubs really don't want that one to be happening. But when you make agreements like that and you've built a big stadium, things have to be done.
Also, I think it's perfect training for the World Cup. We were saying after the Croatia game a couple of weeks back that you need to play decent teams in a warm-up for a World Cup to really see just how good you are. So, although I question where they're playing, it is a good choice of opponent, I think, Brazil there.
So with that in mind, Brendan, could we see a pretty strong English side out then? For that fixture?
I think what's really interesting, actually, since Capello's taken over, people don't be pulling out of friendly squads. No. If they start pulling out of squads, he will not pick them. And I think that's the big difference with England this time, is this fella means real business. So these players know they have to, you know, suit up, show up and do the business, because he will have them out the door.
Okay, Rob, definitely want to look forward to there. Now, during the week, on FM reporter David Brenchley was looking back and talking to local boy Scott Minto, who was a big name down in Chelsea. So David asked Scott what it was like to turn pro, and this is what he had to say.
Loved it, absolutely loved it. Got really good memories of my time at Charlton. When I first broke into the side, we were in what's now the Premier League. It was before the Premier League was created, but it was in the top division, and I played a few games when I was 17, and I got really broke into the side when I was 18. Unfortunately, we went down that year. But I think when you're that age, you're not really sort of taking into consideration whether you're sort of bottom or feeling the pressure. You're just happy to be out there and want to play in as many games as possible, and that's what happened, really.
And obviously, then you moved on to Chelsea. Why did you decide that it was time to move on?
Well, I really did love my time at Charlton, and in the last season I was there, I think that was the 93-94 season, we had a really good chance to go up. I think we actually played Manchester United in the FA Cup in the quarterfinals, and at that stage we were second in the league. In fact, in that game, I think Peter Schmeichel got sent off at half time, and you know, we were sort of thinking, well, in the second we've got a chance of winning this, and apparently Sir Alex Ferguson said, just get them back to the Valley, we'll be happy with that. But they ended up winning 3-1, but at that time in the league we were second, and I thought it was a really good chance to go up. And from after that game we just kind of fell away, and we didn't even finish in the playoffs, and I just thought to myself, my contract was running out, this is not going to happen with Charlton getting into the Premier League, so I need to move on. And I actually had the choice of Chelsea or Arsenal. And I met up with George Graham and spoke to him, but you know, I knew Gavin Peacock at Chelsea. Okay. And obviously his dad Keith was at Charlton, and he was kind of pushing me towards Chelsea, and it was something which I wanted to do. I wanted to play for Chelsea, and looking back now, I don't regret that decision at all. I love my time there.
Yep. And you made your debut in the Cup Winners' Cup, I believe. How different was the challenge? Because obviously you were stepping up from Charlton into European football. How different was it?
It was different, because I don't think the gap between, let's say, what now we call the Championship and the Premier League then was so big as it is now. I think it's a massive gap now.
Yeah.
But then it wasn't such a big gap. The biggest problem that I had, really, was injuries. I got injured. I had an Achilles injury in my first pre-season there, and was out for about 3 months. And Glenn Hoddle, who had had a... He brought me to the club. He'd had a serious Achilles injury himself, and he was very, very good, very understanding. Perhaps a little bit too understanding, because he put me back in the team when I wasn't quite 100% fit, and I kept on breaking down, and it was a very frustrating time in the first year or so.
And then you obviously got to the FA Cup final in 1997. Firstly, tell us about the earlier rounds. Did you sort of go into the third round believing that you could lift the trophy?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's something which, as a kid, again, even just, what was it, 12 years ago now, it was still a massive thing. I think that what's happened with the Champions League, unfortunately, the FA Cup is still big, but it's not quite as big as it was back then. And you don't actually think we're going to win the Cup, but obviously you would love to, but you just sort of take it stage by stage. And of course, there's a game every 3 weeks, so you're concentrating perhaps more on the league. But I think when we played, I think it might have been the fourth round, as early as the fourth round, when we played Liverpool, and we were 2-0 down and came back and won 4-2, we suddenly started to think to ourselves, hold on a second, you know, you hear about names being on the Cup, and is it a bit of a cliche? But we did kind of feel, well, who knows, maybe this is our year. And I think I remember in the fifth round, yeah, against Leicester, I think we had a very disputed penalty in the last few minutes, and it could have gone to penalties, but Frank LeBeuf stepped up, scored the goal, and it was then where I started to really believe that we had a fantastic chance of getting to the final and winning it.
This is the On FM Sports Show.
That was the first half of the Scott Minto interview. Join us after the break for the second half, right after this. Hello, welcome back to the Sports Show 101.4 on FM. Now, we played the first half of the Scott Minto interview before the break. David Brenchley, on FM reporter, went out to meet him. Second part of the interview, he was talking to Scott. He asked him what it was like to play in an FA Cup final at Wembley. And this is the second part of that interview coming up now.
Yeah, it was fantastic. To be honest with you, I kind of remember bits, but I don't remember it all. You either hear people saying, I remember absolutely every minute as if it was yesterday.
Yeah.
Or you hear people saying, I can't really remember much about it at all. And I'm probably falling into the latter. But I do remember the build-up to it was fantastic. We, you know, you had the suits in the week leading up to it. You get measured for that. And yep. I actually had to go on zig and zag as well to promote the Cup final, which is a bit of a laugh. I went on with Suggs, the lead singer of Madness, and we had a bit of a laugh there. And then just turning up at Wembley, one thing Ruud Gullit did very well is he tried to treat it as if it was any other game.
Yep.
You know, if we'd have gone to stay in the hotel on the Wednesday and then stayed till Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I think by come the final, we might well have been sort of a bit mentally tired and maybe even physically tired, just sitting around doing nothing. But we just treated it as if it was just a normal game, as if it was an away game in London. We trained on the Friday at Stamford Bridge, travelled to, I can't remember the name of the hotel now, but we stayed there overnight. Travelled to Wembley, looked around, and obviously when you get interviewed on the pitch, it starts to sort of kick in that this is the FA Cup final.
Yep.
And of course we couldn't have got off to a better start, so that really helped.
Yeah, what was the match like? Obviously you mentioned like Roberto Di Matteo's goal came really early on. Did that give you a massive boost?
Yeah, it did. I mean, we weren't playing like a Liverpool. Well, we'd already beaten Liverpool in the earlier rounds, but even like a Manchester United and Middlesbrough were a good side, but obviously they were, I think they just got relegated as well. But funny enough, we played them only about a month or two earlier away, and Janino scored the winner. So we knew that they'd be tough, but we felt very, very confident going into the game. And once Robbie scored that goal, we really believed that we'd go on and win it. And perhaps should have done, really. We didn't get the second goal. I think Eddie got it, Eddie Newton, yeah, in about the 83rd, 84th minute. And we should have killed the game off before then. I remember Frode Grotus making one really good save. But apart from that, we were pretty comfortable. And, yeah, just felt very, very confident. It was a very hot day, which most FA Cup finals seem to be. But it just kind of, maybe just because it was the FA Cup final, I just felt full of running and really enjoyed the game.
And obviously it's every boy's dream to lift the FA Cup with your home fans cheering for you.
That's right, yeah. It was quite funny because, you know, you look over one side and half the stadium was full of blue and look over the other and it's practically empty. But, yeah, lifting the cup was fantastic. It was great. And perhaps something I didn't quite take in at the time and only sort of sunk in a few days later. And we started, probably we were the first team to actually, let's say, milk being on the pitch afterwards and must have spent about 40 minutes, something like that, just running around, you know, looking at the fans, diving towards the fans and all that kind of thing. We just didn't want to get off the pitch.
And that must have given you, again, a boost. And sort of the adrenaline rushing through you and stuff?
Yeah, definitely, and you know, that kicked on to the evening time, which I definitely can't tell you too much about. we had a lot of drink, but we stayed at Savoy. I think we were going to stay there whether we won or lost, but obviously it makes it so much better when you win, and we really made the most of it, so it was a really good day and night.
Yep. And more on your Chelsea career, who was the best player you played with?
Well, the best player I played with at Chelsea is the best player that I've ever played with, and that is Gianfranco Zola.
Yep, I thought you might say
that. Yeah, he's just off the field, incredible guy, a real team player. He just really wanted to help you out all the time. You know, it wasn't as if he was in my position, but whether it was free kicks, he was teaching me a few things, or unfortunately, Chris still couldn't do it as good as him, but, you know, what it was like as a forward, what a forward's thinking like. And so he was all really helpful to you off the pitch, but also on the pitch, his first touch, his skill. I mean, obviously, he's only small, but he was just, no one could get anywhere near him. He was just incredible. He knew exactly what to do before he was going to get the ball, and he seemed to be, like all top players, have so much time on the ball. And he was just incredible. And I'd probably say number two would be Ruud Gullit, because when he went to Chelsea, his knees were meant to be shot. You know, he was meant to be like, he's finished, he's got maybe a year or two left, and that's about it. But believe me, that got me. If his knees were shot, my goodness, he must have been some beast when he was playing for AC Milan, because he was still big, strong, quick, powerful. No one could get the ball off him. He was a really good guy to play with. But I have to say, Gianfranco Zola was the best by far.
How about the best player you played against?
Best player I played against was, I suppose, in terms of, you know, the best player would be someone like Eric Cantona.
Yep.
I also played against Thierry Henry, who fortunately didn't come down my side too often.
Yeah.
But I'd say probably the guy that gave me the toughest game would be Anders Limpar when he was at Everton and I was at Chelsea. He really had a good day, and it's one of those where he's either hot or cold, and that day he was hot. So on a one-on-one basis, that was probably my toughest game.
And what do you make of Chelsea sort of now this season? Do you think they can push on and regain the Premier League?
Yes, I do. I really believe that this is a year for Chelsea. I think that Carlo Ancelotti's come in. It's still early days. They still haven't played the real top teams, and they will do in October, November. So come the end of November, if Chelsea's still top, I believe they'll definitely win. But I think there's something about, there's a determination there that they don't want to let Manchester United win another Premier League trophy, really. And I think it's 3 years is too long, and they realise that. And I just think with Carlo Ancelotti and the squad that they've got, despite the ban that's going on, we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. I think they've got a good enough squad to win the Premier League. With the Champions League, I just think that's a bit of potluck. You know, that the last 2 years, for me, Chelsea should have been the champions. I believe if they'd have played in the final against Manchester United last year, then they would have beaten United. But for a very, very dodgy referee, should definitely have been gone through to the final.
Okay, thanks for speaking to ONFM Radio, Scott.
It's a pleasure.
Welcome back to the Sports Show 101.4 on FM. That was ex-Chelsea player Scott Minto. We're going to take a quick music break. Join us after this. Now, welcome back to the show. That was The Killers. Now, for all the Irish listeners who tuned in last week, last Sunday, of course, was the All-Ireland football, Gaelic football final, pitching Cork against Kerry, Rob. And Kerry got their 35th All-Ireland title, so probably not the greatest of games for the neutral, but nonetheless, a massive achievement for Kerry, and you know, well done to them, and I'm sure all the Kerry population who live in London were celebrating. We've one of them in here in the studio, even Mr. Horgan.
Yeah, I was extremely, extremely pleased with Kerry's performance against the Rebels of Cork. So,
you're not a bit bored. I think I'm a bit bored seeing Kilkenny winning the hurling and Kerry winning the All-Ireland football.
Well, you can never get bored of seeing your team win every single time, you know.
I don't know, for a neutral anyway, looking at the game last week, I thought the way Kerry came back in the first half and kind of got back into contention after losing that early goal. I know the second half wasn't the greatest spectacle ever, but they did enough to win it, and that's all you can ask in All-Ireland final day, right?
Absolutely amazing work rate by the Kerry lads. Watching the game, I didn't get to see it live. I had to watch it back on the Sky Plus, but watching it back on the Sky Plus, I rewound it back a couple of times because certain players from the Kerry midfield and forward line were back in the defence working so hard to defend. And
well, I know Tom Sullivan got the official man of the match, but for me, I thought Paul Galvin was exceptional for Kerry.
In fact, that's exactly who. Seeing Paul Galvin back and his work rate is phenomenal. He's Mr. Kerry, isn't he, Paul Galvin?
What about Darren O'Sullivan, the first English-born captain to win the All-Ireland? I thought that was fantastic. Been a Greenford lad myself, seeing a fellow Greenfordtonian, Tyr Conor Gales boy, who moved over to Kerry. I see he's lost the old London accent, but fantastic stuff to see a lad born in England picking up the skills here and then going back home and winning it.
That's right. He's the first London-born Kerry captain I think he's the first
English-born.
Kerry captain. And he's gone on to lift Sam Maguire. So.
And he learned his football with Tyr Conor Gales down in Greenford and think moved back to Kerry about the age of 12, Rob.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. I was waiting out for the accent and then I saw him get up there and it was Kerry, so he's definitely lost the accent. So.
Definitely one of the great sports stories of the week. Like you say, Rob, Darren O'Sullivan lifting that title. So Kerry going for 36 next year, Brian, can it be done?
Without a doubt. It's not... Can it be done? It's will it be done? And well, this the was answer's
their,
yes.
This was their sixth final in a row. So
Sligo, you know, next year. Sligo's name on it next year.
Lucky number 7 for next year. We're going to wrap up the show, folks. I'd like to thank Mr. Kerry over there, Brendan Horgan, for putting the show together this week. Rob Brennan for his brilliant updates on soccer and boxing and everything else in the world of sport. And tune in next week, folks. We'll talk to you then.